This series deals with troubling topics including suicide, drug overdosing, and dependent adult abuse. If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. Previously on The Quarterback and the Con Artist.
So the entry point was under the chin, right? So it went up through between the eyes and then out sort of the top of the forehead.
After shooting himself in the head while trying to end his life, Eric Kramer miraculously survives, but he is not in good shape.
Like, his head was an actual bowling ball. His eyes were swollen shut. He was actually still missing the front of his skull, which once the swelling came down, it caved in.
And it was pretty horrific.
The question always is at this point is, when we save him, if we can save him, will his brain be intact?
And the answer to that question is not so clear.
They basically said he has to learn everything again and you have to think of him like a baby.
I'm Jonathan Walton, and this is The Quarterback and the Con Artist. Episode 3, Somebody's Someone.
How do you get to that point where ending your life is the only option?
I know it sounds like a really insensitive question, but I'm just trying to understand why Eric Kramer, who struggles with depression off and on for two entire decades, all of a sudden decides he's finally done with life and pulls the trigger that day in August of 2015. What exactly led up to that moment? What was the tipping point?
Well, there was quite a few things, actually. My oldest son, Griffin, when he was 18, this is back in 2011, Griffin was going to high school at Thousand Oaks. It was during his football season. He was not having a very good experience doing that. And he had been in a drug rehabilitation program prior to coming back to Thousand Oaks High School. And he had been doing well there. But, you know, unfortunately and tragically, Griffin had a drug overdose, a heroin overdose.
And on the morning of Sunday, October 30th, 2011, Eric Kramer gets the phone call that every parent lives in chronic fear of.
I got a phone call from the Lost Hills Sheriff's Department saying, would you mind coming down to the Lost Hills Sheriff's Department? And I said, what for? And they said, well, we'll tell you when you get here. And so I,
What were you thinking?
I didn't have any idea what to think. And I knew whatever it was, it couldn't have been good. And so so I put on some clothes and I drove over there. And as I'm parked, walking up the steps to go in the door, and I didn't make it in the door. And the deputy comes out, meets me on the stoop there, and he says, you know, sorry, Mr. Kramer, but Griffin passed away last night. All I remember feeling or thinking was there's no way to turn that back. There's no way to turn back what you just said.
Griffin Kramer is dead at just 18 years old, his whole life ahead of him.
He was an affable, an intelligent 18-year-old with an indelible sense of humor.
Eric memorializes his son in a powerful chapter in his book, The Ultimate Comeback.
His interests were eclectic. He loved to play football, quarterback like his dad. And Albert Einstein and the late Bears running back Walter Payton were his heroes. Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli and rapper Tupac Shakur were two of his favorite musicians.
One of the lessons we all learn early on is that life is not fair. But for young Griffin Kramer, it seems doubly so. He's born June 24th, 1993, and out of the gate, life seems to be trying to take this kid out. When Eric and his wife Marshawn bring baby Griffin home from the hospital, he will not stop crying. Screaming, really. Wailing. Eric and Marshawn know there's something wrong, so they take him to the pediatrician.
Just the word colic kept coming up by the doctors. Okay, this is really just colic. Just take him back. It'll go away. He'll grow out of it.
But baby Griffin doesn't grow out of it. And as the days pass, the crying just gets worse and worse. His screams are now blood-curdling.
No, something is wrong here. And took him back, and one pediatrician looks at his umbilical cord, and he says, there's a lot of redness around here that shouldn't be here. And so he goes, I want you guys to take him right now to Tarzana Hospital. And so we did. And they did like a spinal tap on him and a host of other tests. Couldn't figure out what was going on, but they clearly knew something was wrong.
So Eric and his wife leave baby Griffin at the hospital overnight for more tests and monitoring. And in a matter of hours, things take a life-threatening turn.
I think we got a call about 4 in the morning. Come on down to the hospital right now. We're taking him into surgery. He's got flesh-eating bacteria called necrotizing fasciitis. Okay, so we rushed down to the hospital, not knowing if he was going to survive. Next thing I know, the doctor comes out, he's out of surgery, he's survived it.
But doctors aren't entirely sure they removed all of the flesh-eating bacteria. So they leave a giant, gaping incision open on baby Griffin's abdomen, just in case they need to get back in there.
They packed it in gauze so he wasn't bleeding.
And baby Griffin survives. And Eric later finds out just what a rarity that is.
In the previous 15 or so years in LA County, they had 8 documented cases of this necrotizing fasciitis on kids.
8 out of the millions and millions of babies?
8.
Wow.
7 of them had died.
7.
And one of them was an amputee.
Wow.
As a kid growing up, Griffin is great, healthy, energetic, happy, excited about everything, especially sports.
His main focus in life was sports. Basketball, baseball, football, everything sports. A very active, very happy-go-lucky kid. Always had a big smile on his face.
That's Robert Espinosa again, Eric's longtime friend and godfather to Griffin and Dylan. Griffin and Espo, though, were really close.
I'd wake up on a Saturday morning with... Billy lived a couple blocks from me, so I did a knock on the door, and he'd be jumping up, trying to look out the window, and, hey, can you make me breakfast? And, you know, he was just a great, great kid.
Griffin was a very intelligent boy.
Patrice Cameron, Griffin's great aunt.
He was very conversive. He liked to ask lots of questions, as I recall, and very inquisitive. He would get kind of introspective a little bit, but nice looking kid and very into sports.
He wasn't shy, you know, and he was going to make you laugh and he was going to make you smile.
That's Jordan Bailey. He meets Griffin in the 4th grade.
Yeah, I was 10 and he was 9, about that age.
And they are inseparable.
I mean, my dad would just drop me off at their house and I would hang out there all day. So we were really good friends when we were younger. Oh, Griffin was the life of the party, you know? He had a very distinct laugh, you know, always playing jokes, and you always knew it was Griffin. If there was a kid that was probably going to stand up on the table and do something goofy or whatever, it was Griffin and make the room laugh.
Griffin has a truly infectious and unique personality. Eric notices that about his boy early on.
He was, I would say, complex in that he was a very, very sweet-natured kid. He might have been 3, 4 years old. This is before school. you know, he'd be in the back seat. We'd be driving down the road. And he's like, you know, who do you think would win in a fight? The head or the heart?
Wow. That's a hell of a question for that
age. For a
age.
Four-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, for an adult. But
anybody, but yeah. Right. So he just had a lot of, for a young person, had a lot of depth to him.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, mostly because I think dispensaries are a little overwhelming and pretentious. That's just me. You do you. But there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people can buy cannabis. You know how most dispensaries make you choose between strains with ridiculous names and you have no idea which one's for you? Well, that's what Mood.com figured out. And by the way, you can get 20% off your first order with promo code Walton. If you go to Mood.com and click Shop by Mood, it'll tell you which strain does what. Want to be more social at a party? There's a flower for that. Need to focus and get work done? There's a flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, there's a flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and arrives in a discreet box. Best of all, everything's backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code Walton. So head to Mood.com and get 20% off your first order now. And he also has a habit of saying exactly what's on his mind in any situation.
I remember going through the airport, I think he was around 7 or something like that, and going through the airport, and there was a woman, okay, holding a baby like mothers do, okay, where you kind of cupped in her forearm. And all of a sudden, he says, oh, there's a fake baby. And keeps on walking. and so, you know, he just had a great little personality to him. And
it's like a one-liner, like a zinger.
Right. But to him, it wasn't. It was just, oh, there's a fake baby. And
did you laugh?
It was hysterical.
But as Griffin gets older, his inclination to say whatever's on his mind starts causing problems. He inadvertently offends his peers. He has trouble making friends. He also has trouble with school.
He had great difficulty processing seemingly simple stuff. And I remember when it came time in second grade, that was the year I was playing for the Chargers down in San Diego. And I remember when it came time to reading, how much difficulty he had with really just simply reading words and couldn't really focus, you know, all that well. When he was about maybe 13-ish, Marshawn, my then wife, and I had him neuropsych tested on the advice of a psychologist.
And overnight, it becomes abundantly clear what the problem is.
On the frontal part of his brain was what controls executive functioning, which is like your organizational perspective, like he had none. And so his brain wasn't going to allow him to sit inside of a classroom and focus on what the teacher was saying, or take notes, or study for a test. Like, that just wasn't going to happen. And imagine how at 13, or all the years prior, how difficult it was anyway fitting in. But the other thing that I think haunted Griffin had no awareness for how he would sabotage the very relationships he was seeking. He had no idea. Think how painful that would be when you think you have friends and no one's calling. But I could see why they weren't calling. Everybody else could see, but him.
And why weren't they calling?
Well, because he would say and do things that would be offensive that to them, he had no idea that he was doing.
Right.
Like, if I was to say to you, Jonathan, I've really noticed on your forehead, you have this amazing welt that I just can't take my eyes off of. And then, oh, what a great day this is. And then go on as if I didn't say anything.
So he was like brutally honest and didn't have like an edit to like keep that to himself.
Right. Right.
Which I find delightful in people.
Okay. But like when you're 10.
No, I know.
And the other person's 10. Yeah. They don't have the maturity to go, oh, you're just being honest.
Yeah.
You know.
And they haven't lived in Los Angeles where everyone's fake. And so honesty is just so refreshing. Like, even if it's offensive, it's like, at least I know what you're actually thinking.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it. But the kids at Griffin's school do not. And as the years pass and as Griffin becomes more isolated, his desire to fit in consumes him.
And I think the inner psychological torture he must have gone through is just heartbreaking.
I mean, friends are everything at that age.
Everything.
Having a group of friends and a social circle and going to parties and being invited, and it's everything.
Everything.
He would just say things that just to be funny, you know, and they, sometimes they would just be awkward.
That's Griffin's younger brother, Dylan. How would you describe Griffin to someone who's never met him?
Loyal. Big heart. In youth baseball, he had a coach. Some other kid's dad, it wasn't like some legitimate coach. But Griffin, this is just speaks to his loyalty. The guy was a little heavier set, and one of the kids had called the coach fat or something. And so Griffin, after the game, just went and punched him. You know, in the handshaking lines after the game, like he's waiting for the kid, just clocked. And, you know, so,
don't call my coach fat.
Yeah. No, I think that's a pretty good description.
And how old was he at this point?
We're talking like 11.
Wow.
You know,
brave.
That's what I would say is brave. Yeah. Super brave.
Were you guys close?
We weren't as close, which is, you know, the shitty part is because we were just about 5 years apart. You know, growing up, he was my older brother and he was always really tough on me. But then we did get a lot closer. Unfortunately, it was only like half a year before he died.
And even though he's a full 5 years younger than Griffin, Dylan sees how isolated and lonely his older brother is growing up and how much trouble he's having in school, his inability to socialize and make friends. And Dylan witnesses how that all snowballs and eventually leads Griffin to drugs.
I think his relationship with drugs was to numb out his feelings of feeling isolated from his peers, not feeling like he could connect to his peers. I think he struggled with being himself. I think he was born a decade too early, because what they have now as far as school programs for learning disabilities is just way more advanced and just better. And I think if he had that at a younger age, he wouldn't have felt so ostracized. I think that he seeks validation from his peers, and for whatever reason he had felt like the only way to get that was when he was high or drunk and acting a fool. And I think that's really the illness that got him. Before one of our bigger heart-to-hearts is, he told me he just wanted to be somebody, someone. It's kind of heartbreaking to sort of repeat that, but he just wanted to be someone, someone. That's all he said. I just wanted to be somebody, somebody. And he didn't feel like he had that.
One of the problems with doing drugs is you tend to attract into your life other people who do drugs. And you mistakenly believe that those people are your friends, when really the only thing you have in common with them is drugs. And that is not the basis for any kind of meaningful friendship.
I think just we can all identify with you want to be connected to people.
Eric sees his son Griffin heading down this path of drug addiction, and he profoundly understands the why of it all.
And so other people who also have their own struggles, they find comfort in using alcohol and drugs just like you do. And okay, so now I've got a little group of people here that I don't really have to look over my shoulder, am I doing or saying the right thing? And nor do you, or you, or you. And I think that's what ends up happening is that if you're Griffin and others, you find ways to get through days that used to be a struggle and now aren't.
And looking back, the cause of Griffin's tragic death at just 18 years old has a lot to do with the people he surrounds himself with.
I just think that he really cared too much about fitting in.
Griffin's younger brother, Dylan.
And didn't realize, like, when you're in high school, you think the cool kids are the cool kids, but then you grow up and you realize that they're just fucking losers. And that's just the reality of it, is, you know, and for whatever reason, he just cared so much about fitting in with the group of kids that he wanted to fit in with, because those, you know, little punks were the ones that the girls were, you know, flaunting towards and having parties and seeming like they were just living life. And for whatever reason, he wanted that.
Once he went to high school, there was not a lot of his friends that he was involved in sports with or that he associated with at that school.
Griffin's godfather, Robert Espinosa.
So he started hanging out with some of the background. He was very easily influenced. So I think that he got in with the wrong group, made some bad choices. He always had a good heart, though.
And it's not long from the day Griffin starts using drugs to the day drugs become a huge problem in his life.
Because of the drug and alcohol choices he was making, his life was now out of control. His school, which never was good to begin with, his social interactions, which were never stable to begin with, and now you enter drug and alcohol problems to the whole scenario, eventually that train is now off the tracks. And just for his own self-preservation, Marshawn and I got him into a drug and alcohol treatment center.
Marshawn is Griffin's mother and Eric's wife at the time. They're divorced now. So Griffin goes away and spends 3 months at a state-of-the-art drug rehab facility in Malibu, about 20 minutes from home.
So now you're around a bunch of therapists, counselors, and other people like you, at basically your age, that have also found themselves in situations like you have.
And Griffin does really well at this place. He gets clean and sober, and he's determined to stay clean and sober. And he starts making big plans for his life. But the statistics for addicts who get clean and sober and stay that way are not encouraging.
The relapse rate is like in the high 90%. Like, good God.
So when Griffin gets out of rehab, he goes back to high school, although Eric wishes he would have sent him someplace else, like a smaller specialized educational program for kids dealing with addiction, because the struggle to stay clean and sober is omnipresent and overpowering for Griffin. And it's not long until he starts relapsing.
I remember running into him on the road and we started talking.
Griffin's godfather, Robert Espinosa.
And I said, man, are you being good now? He goes, I'm trying, but the heroin, it just feels so good sometimes. I'm like, Griffin, you can't do that. But he was, even though he knew it was wrong and he was doing it, he always had a great heart. He was just a great kid. But the drugs, you know, definitely changed his personality a bit.
But to Griffin's credit, each time he falls off the wagon, he gets back up and gets back on. And steals his resolve to never do drugs again. In fact, the night before Griffin is found dead, his little brother Dylan...
I was 13.
And some of Dylan's friends are heading out to Agora High School, about an hour outside the city of Los Angeles.
And then we end up walking down to the high school to go watch these youth football games, because this is what kids did at the time. And go play two-hand-touch football in the other end zone as the game's going on kind of deal. And... actually, funny enough, who do I see there? It's Griffin.
And not only is Griffin there that night, but Griffin and Dylan's dad, Eric, is there too.
I was watching the game from the stands.
And when the game's over, everyone starts heading home, but Dylan and Griffin hang around.
Whatever reason, these group of kids end up dispersing, and then it ends up just being me and Griffin playing catch with the football. He ends up, you know, kind of in a surreal way, expressing like how sorry he was for treating me how he treated me, and basically like just having a heart to heart. And it was just so weird because it's not like it was prompted by really anything. We're just playing catch. We had just played two in touch with some random people. It was just made no sense why he started talking like that. And then come to find out, he was actually doing that with other people that were there too. It was just kind of weird how that night played out. Like there were just people from sort of our old lives that we hadn't seen in a while that we used to be super close to. And they were there, and Griffin had gone up to them as well and expressed to them that he was sort of, you know, going to stop being a dumb kid and turn his life around. And he was saying what school he was, or junior college he was going to go to. He was excited to go play football and had this whole plan and that sort of thing. And it seemed legitimate. And I'm just sitting there playing catch with Griffin, and he's expressing to me how sorry he is for, you know, taking out, you know, his sort of frustrations with life out on me as a little kid, and sort of apologizing as to why that sort of, you know, we weren't as close as probably we should have been.
And unbeknownst to Dylan and Griffin, their father, Eric, is close by, watching this all unfold.
You know, I didn't think it was anything out of the ordinary, you know?
You couldn't hear what they were saying.
No.
But you could see them throwing the ball back and forth.
Yeah.
This heart-to-heart that Griffin is having with Dylan and everyone else the night before he dies is just so uncharacteristic.
Now, you have to understand, Griffin didn't talk a bunch around this time.
And yet, there he is, bearing his soul on that football field to his little brother.
So you could really tell he was really trying to extend an olive branch and sort of like, you know, stop being a dickhead. He was starting to grow up. So I ended up playing catch with him. We ended up hugging each other, say, love you, say goodbye. And he ends up walking out the back entrance of the high school, and I ended up leaving the other way to go back up to my friend's house. And that's the last time I ever saw him.
It's like he was saying goodbye?
It was so strange. It was like he was saying goodbye. Dude, ironically enough, Griffin didn't only do that with me, but in a sense, he also did it with all these other people at that game, at that youth football game that night. It was just, the set and setting was just strange. Looking back on it, it was at Agora High School. It's where we played all of our youth games growing up. It could have been at any high school. It involved people that were there watching younger siblings of the older ones that were friends with Griffin, older adults that were friends with our family back in the day, that Griffin knew as a young kid, that they fell in love with him as a young kid. And so it was just super strange. All these people that were there that had seen Griffin start out as this smart, sweet, try-hard kid to then have all these troubles, to then come back around and say at the end of the night, I'm dealing with those troubles head-on now.
And apologize.
I'm apologizing. I'm taking ownership. I feel bad for my behavior. You know, I still want to make you proud. So he went around to all these people.
And that was all the same night.
That was all the same night.
And Eric is in the stands at this point, watching his two sons throw a football back and forth while having this heart-to-heart. And he sees Griffin going around to everyone else talking up a storm, though he can't hear exactly what's being said.
I have no idea, but it was strange to me that he was talking at all.
It just almost seemed like he was making amends to everyone and trying to explain, you know, he had good intentions and he's going to do better.
That's how I take it, yeah.
And based on Griffin's last words that night, he seemed clean and sober and extremely clear-headed and determined. Never in a million years could anyone have predicted what happened next.
I don't know if Griffin had plans that night to do what he ended up doing. I don't know.
It was October 2011. It was after a football game.
That's Anna Durgan again, Eric's childhood friend, recalling the tragic night Griffin died.
After that game, he went off to hang out with some guys, which was this guy.
A 19-year-old who is ultimately charged in Griffin's death.
They went to a park.
At this time, I believe he was already, Griffin had already been clean. He hadn't had any drugs in his system or whatever. And this kid shot him up with a dose of heroin.
And he couldn't even inject it himself. He was scared of needles.
Griffin's brother, Dylan.
Hey, he only hung around like I think the night he died.
That one time?
That one time.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe one other, but that was it. And
so they weren't friends?
No. No.
And that night turns tragic because the longer someone abstains from heroin use, the more potent it becomes.
From my understanding, with heroin, if you've been clean for a while and you haven't had any drugs in your system or so forth, you cannot go back to the same dose that you had previously. It will kill you. And apparently shot him up with a major dose, and he was foaming at the mouth, apparently, asking for help.
Griffin had an immediate reaction to that heroin.
Eric Kramer.
Almost like in a seizure. Instantaneously, the heroin goes in, and within seconds, eyes are rolling back in his head. He's foaming at the mouth.
And according to Dylan,
is right when it went into his bloodstream, he asked for his mom. Just take me to my mom's.
But the 19-year-old who shoots Griffin up with heroin does not take him to his mom's. Instead, he panics.
And apparently called some of his friends, what do I do, what do I do?
And the advice he receives ends up killing Griffin Kramer that night.
I think he was more concerned about getting in trouble because he had heroin than he was saving Griffin's life.
If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. If you're enjoying The Quarterback and the Con Artist, click that share button right now and text it to your friends and family. And if you can, leave us a 5-star review. The Quarterback and the Con Artist is produced, written, and hosted by me, Jonathan Walton, for Jonathan Walton Media. Executive producers Eric Kramer and Anna Durgan. Audio engineering by Justin Longerbeam. Editing and sound design by Hansdale Shi. Legal counsel provided by Ken Sterling from Sterling Media Law. We've got a lot of incredible stories in the works at Jonathan Walton Media, so make sure you subscribe and keep an ear out.